Jack Hadley, president and curator of Thomasville's Jack Hadley Black History Museum, will be with us in the second hour. And in this first hour, I've got Dr. Christian Hubicki talking about Tallahassee Cassie, the creation of the robotics laboratory, FAMU, FSU School of Engineering. Pretty exciting stuff, so stay with me.
Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny, brought to you by Widden Glass, Tallahassee's first name in glass for your home or office, and by Merry Maids. Call Merry Maids. Relax. And it's done.
In 1945, Jack Widden started a glass company in Tallahassee. Now, over 70 years and three generations later, it's still working every day, doing just as Jack wanted, giving his customers real solutions for replacing window glass, providing custom cut mirrors, and supplying superior bath and shower enclosures. Local building contractors know Widden Glass takes care of Tallahassee business. They prefer Widden because of their precision and mastery of eye-catching storefront glass and countertop glass. It's a fact. When you choose Widden Glass, you're working with real glass people who will take care of you to your complete satisfaction. It's what Jack Widden wanted, and it's been the Widden way of doing business for over 70 years. Widden Glass, Tallahassee's first family in glass since 1945. Call Widden Glass today or visit them online, 850-222-5781 or WiddenGlass.com.
Again, my friend, thanks for being with me on this occasion when we have further opportunity to explore the remarkable town that is Tallahassee, Florida, celebrated for its diversity of thought and ethnicity and race and, you know, all those kinds of things. Those are the things that, at least, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and Visit Tallahassee want us to talk about. But then there are other folks in town who talk about there being two Tallahassees, and especially when you talk to people like Commissioner Jeremy Matlow, you know, he ran on the notion that we really are one Tallahassee, or need to be one. And I think others have echoed some of that same thinking, whether they're in public office or those who are advocating for a more pervasive, I would say, more comprehensive approach to how we manage ourselves as a community, as opposed to resources and conversations being focused on a few or on segments of the community. Trying to broaden that a bit, looking into neighborhoods that tend to get overlooked, and not just for a period of time, but in their history. And it's certainly an oversimplification to say that, well, we're, you know, rated to be one of the most segregated, if not the most segregated, city in America. I mean, and you've heard me, you know, tell you that. I'm reporting what the outcome of Richard Florida's research now some many years ago, and raised the ire of some of those aforementioned organizations and people in places of positions of leadership. You know, trying to, I think sincerely, some of them trying to do their best to bring us all kicking and screaming into the 21st century. And let's, now, let's wave the flag for progress and inclusion. But I think that when it comes down to it, we have to continually ask ourselves, how do I fit into all of that? Where am I in that conversation? You know, I mean, I get it that we're all busy, although the last 7-8 months have been sort of odd. I don't know how busy we've been, you know, couch surfing and binge watching and such. So, If you have any sense of community involvement going on with yourself, you know, you want to listen in on that second hour of the show today. Jack Hadley, he's the president and curator of this Black Archives, Black Museum up there in Thomasville. And as the president and curator, it is named after him, Jack Hadley's Black History Museum. Well, it was now just about a year ago that they were in this quest to preserve the Imperial Hotel, which was part of that Chitlin circuit, part of the series of hotels and restaurants that are identified in the Green Book. Isn't that what it was called, Carl, the Green Book? Yeah. And that was the guide for Black Americans traveling through the South, trying to find those establishments that would welcome them. And the Imperial Hotel in Thomasville is one of those places. So when we are concerned about our present and our future, you know, Mr. Hadley will say to us, let's not forget our history. Now, that's an interesting point of view, I guess, or an interesting comment in that there has been, of late, a stronger effort, I think, to erase that history or to remove monuments of that historical past, that is to say, those places and those statues and other such references to a time long gone that was marked by segregation and structural racism. You know, 1968 is not that long ago, because, I mean, let's see, that wasn't, I was, what, about 10 years old? Yeah. Well, no, I would have been, I was born in 55, so I would have been, 13. Right. Eighth grade? Okay. I mean, I remember the passing of this monumental civil rights legislation. So when you talk about structural racism, is that different than systemic racism? It may be. And I think that might be a distinction there in terms of the way in which those terms are used. To me, structural refers to, generally, laws and codes and ordinances and, local, state, regional, federal. Those restrictions and conscriptions that say, this is the way in which you are to behave. So when 68 comes along, the legislation is passed, discrimination based upon race, creed, ethnicity, gender, all of that goes into place, and it applies to housing and lending and all that sort of thing that is critical to any one individual and any group of individuals having an opportunity to excel or to participate in. Systemic may be a lot more about process. It may have a lot more to do with sort of embedded attitudes that are just functional. Okay? So let's talk about seatbelts and speed limits. Right. So we know what the rules are, the laws that govern such behavior. Well, the systemic part of that is whether or not you and I rebel against that in our own minds. We just don't think it's a good idea. You got that going on right now with masking. So there's a county ordinance, you know, and the governor has said, well, we're in phase three of reopening. Turns out law enforcement hasn't been penalizing anybody for not abiding with this ordinance. So county officials are going to have to sit back and figure out, okay, well, once we see what the governor has actually sent us in terms of the ruling, you know, then they're going to have to figure it out. My suspicion is that probably by this time next month, maybe sooner, that ordinance will be lifted. And while it yet may be lifted, the systemic part of that may be that people continue to wear masks. So I'm putting the emphasis there to say, as we look forward to the expansion of Tallahassee, as we go on about celebrating our diversity, which again is a nice thing to say, but then it comes back to the systemic aspects of that. Are you invited to the dance, we'd say? Do you get included when that list of people who are interested in the things that you're interested in gets passed around? Do you find it odd that you're always the last one to know? Stay with me.
Witten Glass takes care of Tallahassee business. Local contractors know Witten Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. They prefer Witten Glass because of their precise window glass replacement, masterful shower enclosures, and storefront glass. Witten Glass will take care of you to your complete satisfaction. That's been Witten's way of doing business for 65 years. When you call Witten Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best. Like Witten's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Witten Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. We've done hundreds of storefronts in the Tallahassee area. That's why Witten is known for taking care of business. Witten Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781.
Hi, I'm Melissa Bruner, and you're listening to Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Welcome back to this here fine radio show, Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. You can email us anytime, topics at tallahasseetalks.com. Of course, the website is always there for you. And in regard to this upcoming segment with Dr. Christian curator extraordinaire. He's been on television repeatedly. He was on this game show, Survival, I think it's called. Anyway, interesting fellow, very curious sort of guy. And I mean that both in terms of his curiosity and his rather unique approach to the world. Anyway, he's involved with this development of this Tallahassee Cassie, leads the research over there in robotics, FAMU, FSU, School of Engineering. Fascinating guy. I think you'll enjoy the conversation. He's with us here for the rest of the hour. And I should point out that, in fact, when it comes to his work, there's a lot of evidence of that, and we're going to put a link at the website since I mentioned it. If you go to the website, TallahasseeTalks.com, you will find a YouTube video there for you to view Tallahassee Cassie firsthand, a little robot that they have been working on. And that was a year ago now, this conversation from back in, let's see, when was that? Back in June of last year, better than a year ago, and no doubt the progress has been remarkable in regard to the advancement of Tallahassee Cassie. But it points to the sort of disparity that we experience in some respects as I talk about the way in which Tallahassee is diverse and yet sort of separated or segregated from various ways, many of us working within the private sector, others working for government in some capacity. I think the majority of those employed in this area are city, county, state employees, or Florida State University, FAMU employees. So they work for government in some capacity and characteristically then have sort of their own timetable. You know, it tends to generate a kind of mentality, I think, in terms of, I guess what I'd call herd mentality. Everybody just kind of moves along, you know, living in their quarters, retiring to their quarters in some sector for the evening, and then making their trek back in during the day. And it's that way. You know, so many of these folks that we've talked to, they'll have at least two jobs. You know, so she's working for a department of something at Florida, you know, the state of Florida, and then he's got his position working for the county. And then on the weekends, he's got his lawn care business, and she's got her part-time job at Publix. That is not an uncommon scenario for Tallahassee families. But you think about how that keeps you sort of locked into this circle of friends and activity. Not a whole lot of time for breaking away, and not a whole lot of resource if you're wanting to participate in some of the cultural events, we'll say, that have to do with more than you know, football game or a baseball game, your kid's soccer game. Right. So that in and of itself, I mean, the university has its entertainment, the School of Music and such that it brings. But generally speaking, it's just out of price, out of range for most people in terms of what they can afford. So they're hitting the $5 movies, you know, and they're renting or they're buying films on demand. Think about how they've spent this last 6-8 months this year. You know, now having to care for their kids at home, you know, so a lot of them not being able to do anything more than that. So if we are really unaware of each other, it isn't because we are somehow determined to stay separate. It's life. And I think it's our endeavor here to get you back in touch with other kinds of folks. So if you don't go up to Thomasville to check out Jack Hadley's History Museum, Black History, well, you're missing out, man. Right. And if you don't take some time and check out what Dr. Hubicki's doing with the robotics laboratory up there at the School of Engineering, I mean, what are you doing? And how, when you talk about Tallahassee, how do you make reference to the things that we do? How the people at Leon County make reference to the things that are critical to our well-being. So I got a fistful of notices here from them, including this notice about the 2020 census. Leon County wants to make sure that you make it count, and you can learn how to do that if you go to leoncountyfl.gov/census. You can update all kinds of information there for yourself. So, again, leoncountyfl.gov, census is the keyword there for the 2020 census. From the Department of, or the Office of, Economic Vitality, which is Tallahassee-Leon County's source of economic information, reporting now that City of Tallahassee's employment is down a bit year over year by about 7%. Leon County likewise down about 5% year over year. County total taxable sales is down 2%, just about $438 million year over year. Unemployment is up a bit, about 3%. And I'm looking too at, that was for a city. Leon County unemployment up about 3%. Year over year, both of those statistics. So, you know, not particularly great news. New business utility starts down 3%. So, I mean, it's not surprising given all that we've been through and are still enduring. Meanwhile, I would report to you our concern about you staying prepared for severe weather as we go through the rest of this season and into next year. TallahasseePrepared.com is the place to go. Learn everything you need to know about keeping your family safe and your business prepared for severe weather throughout the year. TallahasseePrepared.com.
My dog was in bad shape, and I was scared. I had never seen her so sick, and my mind was racing. What to do? Who to call? I mean, I raised her from a puppy. She's like my best friend. A few years ago, she developed diabetes, and I've been following her daily regimen carefully.
Care of business,
but that morning,
something
just wasn't right.
When you
she
call
could barely move,
Glass,
and
you're
I thought,
dealing with
I'm
experienced, reliable professionals who
I called
offer
a friend,
only the best.
And he said, call
like
Dr. Pliskin.
Witten's top-of-line
so
bath
called
enclosures
Mayhem
that provide style
put me through
and
immediately,
luxury
and Dr. Pliskin
an
said to get her
price.
There right away.
Eye-catching
turns out,
storefronts
her blood sugar
are
had dropped dramatically, but he knew exactly what to do.
Design it and install it.
Yes, you know. There's no other place I would go knowing that Mayhem Animal Clinic and
call
Dr. Pliskin are there for me and Aaron.
Special people and special care for those you love. Mahan Animal Clinic on Mahan Drive near Costco. On the web at mahananimalclinic.com or call 402-0557.
Bringing you whatever Tallahassee is talking about this week. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Fascinating world of robotics, legged locomotion, optimal control, biomechanics, all of this happening around us. So it is that the work of Dr. Christian Hubicki has been noted nationally, having been reported on things like Outrageous Acts of Science, the Science Channel. He's been on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and a contestant on the very popular TV show Survivor. He is our guest this morning, Dr. Christian Hubicki. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Thank you very much for having me, Brian.
I want to say further that Dr. Hubicki is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering, Florida State University, and the FAMU-FSU College of Engineering, where in 2018 he founded the Optimal Robotics Laboratory at the College of Engineering. With all of those accomplishments having been brought forward prior from his work at Oregon State University's Dynamic Robotics Laboratory. His doctoral work focused on designing and controlling two-legged robots and analyzing the running behavior of birds. This guy's the real deal. 2015, joined the Georgia Institute of Technology as a postdoctoral fellow. What a pleasure having you here. And from all the reports, we want to credit Mark Wolheiser for the reference here. He was on the phone with me one afternoon. He said, Brian, you got to have this guy on your show. He's a delightful soul and brilliant and is on this cutting edge of research and mechanical engineering and all of that. Where do we start in talking with you? I mean, it's amazing. Some of the things that you've been sharing with us prior to the show take my breath away.
Oh, it's very kind of you. In terms of where we start, I guess I have to start by thanking Mark for saying such nice things about me.
Mark's a good man.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. I think I owe you some baked goods next time I see you. I couldn't ask for a better introduction. Thank you. Yeah. So it's my entire sort of career. I've always been interested in robots, how robots move around, and particularly how we can get robots to move the way we move, or at least as well as we move. I mean, you're probably, you know, you're sitting at home, you're maybe in your car listening to this right now, and without thinking, you know, you're maneuvering the wheel of a car, you're assessing the situation around you, or if you're walking around or jogging, listening to your iPod, I mean, you're probably not thinking too hard about what you're doing. You're putting one foot in front of the other. You're pushing off, with your back foot and landing on your front foot, and you're making all of these very sophisticated and elaborate calculations without even realizing it. And here in robotics, we've been making advances, you know, over many decades of trying to make robots better, but we're still not as good as people. And I mean, people are, not only are we very fast runners, we're faster than our fastest robots that run on two legs. We are remarkably stable. You know, even someone who's as uncoordinated as me can slip on some ice and occasionally catch myself. That's remarkable. And we're also very efficient at how we run around. And we don't use much energy. And our energy source is our food, or the food that we eat. Robots run on battery supplies. So we have to worry about our So if we have a robot that has to run around, we have to care about how much energy it uses. Mm-hmm. And we use, and robots use a lot more energy per mile that they walk than people, a lot more.
Interesting.
So as much as I'm really proud of the work that I've gotten to be a part of in working with legged robots and programming them and designing them, we know we have a long way to go to be as great as people are. It's an interesting challenge, but it's one that I find very fun and fruitful to work on.
Just from that description, I can tell there's this massive intersection then of all of these fields of study.
That's exactly right. There are problems across the entire spectrum of robotics that are very difficult but interesting. You're talking about the having a power supply on board the robot that has a lot of energy. And batteries, they're getting better all the time. They're getting better. But still, we have an excellent way of storing energy in our bodies in fat. It's a chemical process.
Yeah.
And we get a ton of energy from our food. So we're trying to find ways to store energy better. That's one way. Another way is once you have that energy on your robot in the form of a battery, how do you turn that stored energy into energy that goes into your walking motion, into actual mechanical power.
Right.
So, you know, we have electric motors, we have hydraulic actuators. They're all good in their own ways, but you know what are really amazing at turning energy into work? Muscles.
Particularly interested in this comment you made earlier about the interaction between the brain's activities, right? And so you said, well, you know, think about the brain's capacity. We haven't even touched how capable the human brain is, but the ability for that brain to communicate directly with, let's say, a prosthetic arm.
Right. So what you're talking about, Brian, you're right. I find it very interesting. Is the entire field of brain-machine interfaces. Now, this is not my direct field of research. Like, if I were to get involved in brain-machine interfaces, I would probably work with an expert in the field of medicine. But the idea is, how much can we get the brain to communicate with devices that are not our bodies? So you're talking about a prosthetic arm. Someone has lost their arm. Can we build a mechanical arm that you could actually interface with using your brain? So you just think about picking up the coffee cup and it picks up the coffee cup. Yeah. You don't have to operate a joystick with the other hand to do it. And there was kind of a basic research question for the people in neuroscience who study this is, what is the brain's capacity to adapt to new devices? So like, we, you know, our brain is very good at handling control of our body, you know, all of our fingers, all of our toes, we can wiggle them around. Mm-hmm. But how good is it at adapting to other modes of interacting with the environment? If you had, let's say, imagine you had, instead of two arms, you had eight arms. You had six robotic arms, like Dr. Octopus from Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. How would our brain would be able to handle that? Would it be able to adapt to it, or be sort of overloaded and not know what to do with it? Mm-hmm. But it turns out our brains are quite plastic, and there is a way, and they're remarkably good at adapting to seemingly without limit. All kinds of devices connected up to it. So imagine the possibilities there. Now, again, this is not my direct field of research, but you could imagine what kind of things are capable in the future. Obviously, there's a lot of ironing out in technology to do.
Sure.
Any kind of progress on anything having to do with medical research has to go through all kinds of layers of approval and safety.
Yeah, yeah.
I think people who work in that field are very excited, and justifiably so. So, like, I work in robotics, and the nice thing about robotics is that while robots are complicated to build, once you have them built, you can just try things with them, you know, things that I wouldn't dare try with a human patient, right?
Yeah.
We can create a whole new algorithm, throw it on the robot, and the worst thing that happens is, you know, we break the robot, which would be a big setback. But there are no ethical concerns with this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So one thing that's nice in robotics, so like when I'm experimenting with our legged robot, we have a legged robot in our lab called Tallahassee Cassie. That's the name of the robot. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like an ostrich robot. So when we are trying to get this robot walking better, we can rapidly iterate on the algorithms and try things, right? And that helps. And the more you can try things, the more likely you are to get a breakthrough. Mm. With something like medicine, you know, justifiably, there are all kinds of safeguards and levels of clinical testing that you have to go through because you have people's lives in the balance.
Right.
So they have a much longer time frame for really making sure everything pans out well.
You started your research and in your endeavors in this area of study for many years ago Where did you start? Where was the sort of the departure or point of departure when you said, this is the field that I want to pursue?
I think
what drew you in, I guess.
So the robotics has the uncanny ability of wrapping people in when they're very young. Normally, it's when I was like probably 5 years old, I got a set of Legos for Christmas. My parents got me Legos with a motor at the back. Back in the day, it was a very, very simple control system you could do. There's a button that would turn it in one direction, a button that would turn it in the other. And I would make little robots with that. And that was my spark of my interest that I like doing this. And then sort of my gradual culmination of this is that I would join a high school robotics team. And then I would go, then so that got me more involved. And then I would, in undergraduate, so when I went to college, I majored in mechanical engineering because that was one of the, a good path to join robotics.
But then I
started doing research as an undergraduate student.
We're talking with Dr. Christian Hubicki. He is the Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Florida State University, FAMU-FSU College of Engineering, our guest this morning. You stay with me. We've got more right after this.
Hi, I'm Josh, and this is an ad for Supersigns. We were going to do an ad that was funny or maybe really dramatic, you know, something clever, but that just didn't work. So I'm just going to tell you, Supersigns is great. I mean, they're really great. And it's not just me saying it. Lots of people posting and talking to their friends. Here's one. We are so happy with all our signs and banners by Supersigns. Highly recommend. Here's another. These guys are awesome. They run their business with great quality and service. Our lighted sign looks fantastic. I can't rave enough. Supersigns does the really big stuff, like outdoor lighted signs, vehicle wraps, wall murals, and all the banners, the yard signs, and indoor signs, too. So for your business or your birthday party, Supersigns is your sign company. So that's it. That's our ad. Supersigns is great. I mean, really, really, really great. You should call them, 422-1883, or go to their website, yoursupersigns.com. How's that for clever?
Hi, I'm Jerry.
And I'm Pete.
And we're with the Jerry Thigpen Trio, and you're listening to Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
So we're talking about robotics and legged robots.
Tallahassee Cassie.
Cassie has these abilities that are not only mechanical, but you referred to it earlier, that are programmed.
Right.
As the mechanics advances, the programming has to be there. Which comes first, I guess?
Or is it
simultaneous?
To be frank, it has to be simultaneous. That the people who are programming the robot know it, they need to know how it's built, and people who are building the robot need to know how it's going to be programmed. So that's actually a very complicated process that we have to undertake. In terms of what Cassie can do, Cassie has the unique ability that when it steps around, you know, we tell it to go in a direction and it walks in that direction. So it's deciding how to place its feet. And then when it encounters, say, a curb, it just steps on it and keeps going. But the remarkable thing about Cassie is that it's blind. Cassie has no vision. We just tell it which way to go. And without being able to see what's in front of it, it's able to step on it, adapt to it, and keep going. And you might be like, Why is that important? And the answer is, yes, that's very important. Because you or I, Brian, if we're walking out in a hilly field,
right,
we could cover our eyes and just start walking forward, and we don't need to know where every divot, every bump, every little gradation of the ground is in order to just keep walking. So that's very important, not only so when we want robots walking outside in the real world, you know, where maybe we want them delivering our packages, we want them maybe running into a burning building to check to see if anyone's inside, we may be wanting them to go into power plants that are on the fritz. Now, you know, nuclear power plants can be very dangerous places if things go wrong. There was a big, everyone sort of knows the big disaster in 2011 with the Fukushima Daiichi power plant in Japan after that big tsunami.
Right.
So the power plant was on the fritz and it's spitting out radiation and you can't send people in there. The idea was that you send in robots, right? Problem was the robots couldn't get around in the power plant. You know, they had these tracked robots that would get stuck. So that was this big impetus by our government. We said, we don't want that happening here.
Right.
They put out a big research program through a big research grant to many universities to develop the next generation of walking robots. And that's what I was working on at Oregon State when I was doing my PhD there. So we want robots to be able to go wherever people can, but perhaps don't want to at this exact moment. That's the goal. So Cassie's ability to be able to walk around without being able to, use vision to say, see where every pebble on the ground is, and walk outside in a field.
And that's happening because Cassie has sensors of some kind in its feet, right, that it can incorporate into its thinking.
Yes. And it's also how it's programmed. It's able the way it's programmed, it's able to adapt to the environment. It doesn't need to have a highly certain estimation of what's around it.
It can handle approximation.
Yeah, it can handle uncertainty of its environment. That's a big part of the programming, and also how it's built can handle help that too.
So what does that look like? Does that mean that in some respects it's a kind of an approximation then, right? Mm-hmm. So the algorithms involved in the program are going to say, anything close to this means that?
Yeah, more or less. It's able to take a whole suite of situations that it might not be able to know or describe, whether and would just categorize them as disturbances. Uh-huh. So if you and I are walking around and we accidentally sort of, you know, kick our foot, we stub our toe,
right,
or someone bumps into us, or maybe there's a little slippery puddle on the floor or something, we might be able to categorize this as all different things. Yeah, but Cassie just sees these all as something, all the sort of the same thing, just some kind of disturbance. And then it just reacts to it and tries to catch itself. And that's the programming. But you mentioned whether or not the programming, the mechanics need to be done together. The answer is yes, because the mechanics are also very unique in that Cassie, unlike a lot of other robots, is actually very flexible. It's springy. It's got springs in it.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you think of a factory robot, if you were to go to a factory somewhere,
right,
and you were to turn off one of those car assembling robots, and you or I were to go up to it and try to move that arm around, we couldn't do it. It's rigid. It won't move. Cassie, however, is very flexible. And why would you want flexibility? Well, it's like having a suspension on your car. Your car has suspension. Your car has shocks that are flexible. So what happens when your car hits a pothole? The shocks absorb that. Mm-hmm. So Cassie has shocks too. Basically, Cassie has shocks on it. So that's really nice from a mechanical standpoint, because you wouldn't dare drive your car off road without shocks. That'd probably end your vehicle.
Right.
So how does the programming come into this? Well, once your robot becomes flexible, the programming and control theory becomes much harder.
Curiously, in the process of creating these advances and what you've done thus far and where you're heading, do you start with the human experience? And we'll talk about brain activity and such. Is that your template and you're working forward to how do we replicate what the human experience is? Or do you say, well, this is what mechanical science tells us will work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always fascinated with these construction sites. You have a crane that can handle a massive amount of weight and not tip over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so all of the, let's say, mechanical engineering, the science of that is mathematical, right?
Yeah, it is a great question.
So do you start, or is it, again, simultaneous kind of thing?
So do we take inspiration from animals for our robots? Absolutely, all the time. In our case, with a two-legged robot, we have the idea, from humans, but also ostriches and chickens and all these birds that we study in past research. They get around on two legs just well, and they're able to get over rough terrain, right?
Yeah.
So we take that idea from them. Then it's tempting to say, well, why don't we just slap motion capture markers on a person, see how they move their legs, and then just put that on the robot? Turns out that's not a great idea because the robot is built differently than a person. It's got it weighs differently. It uses different kinds of motors to use. So at what level do we take inspiration from biology?
Uh-huh.
And the research that I've been doing along with collaborators in biology has been pointing to the idea of you take inspiration from what people care about when they're walking. When you are walking down the street, you might not be consciously aware of it, but you are balancing what we call objectives, goals. In determining exactly how you walk, exactly how you swing your legs. So it's been a research program of ours to figure out what are those goals of people? Because if we know those goals, Then we can turn that into a computer algorithm that says, oh, you gave me the goals in terms of a math equation? Perfect. I can tell the robot how to achieve those goals. I can do that. I can do that. Mm. And turns out a big goal of how we get around is that we care about how little energy we use. We want to be lazy. We don't want to use extra energy than we have to. I mean, just think about it. When you're walking slow, or when you have to move slowly, do you run in place very, very slowly? No. You get tired. You don't do that. But when you and similarly, when you walk really fast, when you want to go really, really fast, do you walk? Well, unless you're an Olympic power walker, no. You prefer to run. And that's because it takes less energy. And thankfully, that's something we can tell robots to do. We can take a computer algorithm and say, computer algorithm, this is how the robot's built. Find a way to walk while minimizing energy costs. And wouldn't you know it, it starts walking like a person.
Remarkable.
So we don't tell it to walk like a person. The idea is that it figures it out on its own.
It figures it out based on the goals that are presented.
Exactly.
We need you to get from here to there in this amount of time.
Exactly.
You figure it out.
Right. Yeah. So we call that an optimal control problem in engineering, that we want to find the optimal, the best solution to the problem. That's why I call it the optimal robotics lab.
Okay, my friend. Well, you have completely exhausted my ability to contain any further this information. So, of course, this means you have to make several return visits to the show. we'll consider you a regular, recurring guest with your kind permission. Wow. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian.
For this moment. Dr. Christian Hubicki, Assistant Professor, Mechanical Engineering, Florida State University, FAMU, FSU College of Engineering.
That's what I have for you at this point in the show, my friends. Coming up to the top of the hour, we've got more Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny, so stay with me.
Witten Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. When you call Witten Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best. Like Witten's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Witten Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. Witten Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781.
Hi, I'm Tom Flanagan. You're listening to Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Welcome back to the second hour of Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny, your humble host, as we navigate through all kinds of interesting points of information and activities. The county's reporting a continuing decrease in the weekly documented number of new COVID cases. So as of, let's see, the date of this report, I believe, was the 28th. I'm going to double-check that for you. Yeah. So as of the 28th, weekly documented new cases down to 487. It's about almost half, down from 808 cases prior. So that's about a 5.5% rate of positive cases. So again, weekly percent of the positive cases decreasing. Weekly emergency room visits with flu-like symptoms actually increasing, but largely that has been attributed to the time of year. Flu tends to happen. And with students and such having closer contact anyway. Weekly emergency room visits with COVID-like illnesses decreasing again this week, down to 41 from 43 visits. So this is, generally speaking, encouraging news. And of course, there's talk of federal government, Trump administration, sending out all of these test kits. And saw, if you didn't see it demonstrated for us, it looks like it's a pretty simple procedure that you can self-administer. So that's good. And I guess everybody else, too, hoping and waiting for a vaccine in the very near future. Other rather interesting news regarding our development. I said to you earlier in the show, when we talk about our own diversity, think about this. You know, Tallahassee was the place where a couple of legislators met 100 and 60, 70 years ago and decided this is a good spot. They're both tired of traveling. They met here and decided this was going to be the place for us to set up the state capital. Of course, in that day, in those days, it was still a territory. But in any case, Tallahassee became the hub of that all happening. And as it developed, you know, it was the magnet for other such things to happen. And, you know, you can look at the economic development of Leon County, largely dependent upon coastal cotton. And because coastal cotton, this is a type of cotton that produces a fiber that then results in a superior fabric. So it's highly, highly prized in the area of Leon County, right along the coast here. You know, ideal conditions. And so people like, you know, Francis Epps and others, Crump, Chairs, they all moved here to make their fortune. So, you know, you look at the number of plantations that were growing cotton in those days, we'll say the early 1800s through pretty much the end of the century. I mean, Leon County had more plantations than any other county in Florida, right? And 75% of the population was enslaved. And that was the foundation upon which Florida State University, then first recognized as the West Florida Seminary. Historians give Francis Epps credit for that, although some want to now question that. In any case, more often, Francis Epps, first mayor of Tallahassee and the one who appointed folks to serve as a police force, you know, he was contributive to Tallahassee going beyond its rather frontier status. If I'm not mistaken, there was a horse track in the center of town, and gunfights daily were not uncommon. And old Francis Epps says, you know what, we need to try to civilize these folks. So he establishes a police force and goes about petitioning the legislature for funding. And they agreed. It took them 3 years, and they finally said, okay, we'll give you the money. There'll be the East Florida, that is to say a seminary east of the Suwannee. And that ended up in Ocala and later on Gainesville, now known as University of Florida. Similarly, West Florida Seminary goes through its various transitions through the Civil War as a military institute and ends up as a co-ed institution, now known as Florida State University. Well, my thesis says that there's very little change in the mentality that made Leon County what it was, as a basically a factory that produced a product, principally. And that mentality requires, more than anything else, consistency, turning it out over and over and over again. Innovation, not a big part of that. Good administration, good management, you know, slave labor, all part of that equation. And Leon County was quite successful, at least for those who were in those positions of ownership. Well, it happens that we live in this time when we have people like Jack Hadley reminding us of what that history was all about. He's going to be with us here in this hour. He's the curator of the Black History Museum in Thomasville, and identified as the Jack Hadley Black History Museum. When we talked with him about a year ago now, he was in the process of preserving the historic Imperial Hotel. He was successful in that effort. But as a opportunity for us to think back through our own history, the history of this community. It gives us pause when we take a look at what Dr. Hugh Bickey is doing over there at FAMU's Florida State's School of Engineering in robotics against what was at one time an entirely agrarian economy. I guess if you will consider my thinking here, that agrarianism, what I call plantation mentality, continues because we have a workforce that moves from one part of the county to the other. You know, you live in your quarters up here, and then you come out and you work the fields and you go back home at night. Well, why do you need to innovate? Why do you need to make any change? But with the opportunity to bring new industry to the community, like what has happened recently with Innovation Park, they got $10 million from the federal government. That's a game changer, and it will open up job opportunities for the next 25, 30, maybe 50 years. But it'll result in more in-migration, that is to say, people being brought to our community who are going to be working in those industries that will spawn from this North Florida Innovation Lab facility. What about the rest of us who've already been here, who grew up here? What kind of opportunities will you and I create for ourselves that may actually spin off of these larger efforts? That's the challenge that we face. And as we do so, we would benefit by paying attention to our history.
Witten Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. When you call Witten Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best. Like Witten's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Witten Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. Witten Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781.
Good morning, friends. This is your friend, Dr. Benjamin Franklin. We're talking with Brian Cerny on Tallahassee Talks.
The Negro Motorist Green Book, at times styled the Negro Motorist Green-Book or titled the Negro Traveler's Green Book, refers to an annual guidebook for African-American road trippers commonly referred to simply as the Green Book. There's a popular film you would probably have heard of, and this happened from 1936 to 1966, and it was during that era of Jim Crow laws, although pervasive racial discrimination and poverty limited black car ownership, the emerging African-American middle class were buying up cars as quickly as they could. The problem was they faced a variety of dangers and inconveniences along the road. I mean, and this could range from being refused lodging and food to some arbitrary arrest, being accused of stealing a car, whatever. So Victor Hugo Green, in response, wrote this guidebook to provide safety and direction for those who were traveling. It would point out there were services and places where they could stay that were relatively friendly to African Americans, and eventually his work expanded to much of North America. Among those properties listed in the Green Book is the Imperial Hotel, located in Thomasville, Georgia. It stands today as testimony to that time, an era when discrimination, segregation was widespread and open. It so happens that rather than fall upon a darker and ultimately troubled future, the Imperial Hotel has been saved. And it's happened largely because of the work of one man, Jack Hadley. Formerly, James Jack Hadley, but to his friends, Jack is the one person among many who have taken up this charge in saving the Imperial Hotel. He is our guest this morning, and it's a pleasure to have you with us, Jack. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Doing fine.
All of 82 years young, I understand.
There you go. 82 years young and feel good at this age.
You have brought this to our attention as a community in recent days, but the fact is this is a lifelong work for you, or at least a work of many years in which you have labored not just in relation to the Imperial Hotel, but all of your work with the museum that you founded and now are the curator, the Jack Hadley Black Museum. Tell us about the museum and its history.
One thing about the Black Jack Hadley Black Museum, it didn't start overnight. It's been about a 40-year journey that I've been on.
Wow.
And I said this because this journey really started back in 1979 when I was stationed, Lindsay Air Station, Wiesbaden, Germany. I'm a military veteran, retiree of 28 years in the Air Force. Mm. We were stationed over at Lindsay Air Station, Wiesbaden, Germany, and my three young kids was going to a Department of Defense school that was taught by Americans, that they was teachers, you know, contract teacher at school. My son came home one day and said, "Dad, this is Black History Week, and the teacher don't seem to have no interest in Black history." And what I did, right then, I got off the sofa, and we put together exhibits from Ebony Magazine, Jet Magazine, and the Pittsburgh Courier paper. Hmm. Those papers are the one that you would get being overseas in Germany or any place in Europe. You didn't hear much about the Black, what's going on back in the world, we call it. So you subscribe for that so you stay abreast of what's happening. Mm-hmm. So we put together the collage, and my son Jim took it to school, about three or four sections of it, and the teachers liked it, the students mm-hmm. liked it. Mm-hmm. Then I realized what I did, that we put together, then I asked my commander if we could also in the squadron celebrate Black History Week. So my commander told me, said, "Jack, you guys go ahead on and use the day room and set everything up." Mm. And so we notified all the airmen, you know, in the squadron, the female and male, and made the announcement. I'm in a first combat communication squadron, so when we went on remote locations in North Africa and Middle East, we would be the first ones in and the last ones out. So we took advantage of those little privileges to go and shop around down in a little small village
right.
until the main part of the base get there, and then that's in that. They had to put rules on. So anyway, that's how they obtain stuff out of North African different places. So they pull that, we all put it together into the day room and fix it up. And that was the beginning of it in Germany. When Wiesbaden, Germany. After about a couple of years doing that, then I transferred back to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and stationed at the base there because it's closed today. They closed several years ago. And I saw that there was a lack of Black History Week being you know, exhibit. So I got the people involved with that. And then I retired in 84 and came back to Thomasville. That's my home, Thomasville, Georgia, where I was born and raised at. Finished high school there. Mm-hmm. And I dealing with Black history, and then one of my deacons in the church, Tommy Gable, he said, "Jack," he said, "look like you're interested in collecting Black history. I like church history. Why don't we do something in the basement of the church, set up an exhibit?" And we did that. I got more posters and prints and stuff like that. We put them on a concrete wall, use masking tape and stuff like that to exhibit. Mm-hmm. And then I guess the community caught on what I was trying to do, because I felt that back in that time, we're talking about back in the 80s or the early 90s, Blacks mm-hmm. They were reluctant to show their Black faces on the walls of the museum, because mm-hmm. I could tell by people just not getting involved. So then the Thomasville Center for the Arts find out what they call the culture center at the time, that what we were doing. So mm-hmm. then it was Black history stretched into a whole month now. Mm-hmm. They said, "Jack," he said, "if you guys want to use the culture center, which seats about 500 people and then mm-hmm. had up and downstairs, the exhibit room, y'all can do so in the basement mm-hmm. and set up the exhibit for the whole month and mm-hmm. use the culture center for the whole month." They call it today this Center for the Thomasville Center for the Arts. And we did that, and it just mushroomed. People started donating, and I started creating. And that was, that really was beginning with the church here in America with less than 100 pieces, right up to the Culture Center was the beginning of it. And then the Culture Center changed directors. A new director came on board, said, we're going to redo the green room on the lower level where you had to exhibit. So we're going to take you up. You can go up on the third floor. This is in a big old school that was built back in 1901 and had windows all the way around. And I said, no, I can't do that. It's too much light exposure to my collection for a whole month. So I just discontinued on the Culture Center. And then the school started calling me. The organization started calling me to bring and set up my exhibit to different places. I did that.
Wow. Well, and folks, if you're looking for some motivation, you found it. This morning we've got Jack Hadley here, and we're going to get the story on this Imperial Hotel that you've recently purchased. You stay with me, folks. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. We'll be right back.
Witten Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. When you call Witten Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best. Like Witten's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Witten Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. Witten Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781.
Bringing you whatever Tallahassee is talking about this week. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
So we've got Jack Hadley here talking about the Imperial Hotel, its significance as one of those along the Chitlin Circuit, as it was known back in the day, when African-American artists were not allowed to perform except in certain locations. Our own Bradfordville Blues Club is an example. The Imperial Hotel then was the place for African-American bands and musicians to stay during that period of time, all the way from the 40s through the 60s. And I'm sure that if the walls could speak, they would be able to tell us about people like Ray Charles and Cannonball Adderley and all kinds of folks that probably made their way through the Imperial. The location of the hotel where it stands is its original spot, and it's kind of cool because it's right there sort of at the gateway into downtown Thomasville, isn't
yes.
it? Yeah. Now, this has been quite a journey. Tell us a little bit about how you've gotten this far.
Yeah, let me go back before we touch on that piece. The Imperial Hotel came up back in 2013 when there was a conversation with we had a museum assessment program of the museum. I got about 5,000 items on the wall of the museum.
Wow.
Exhibits. And we cover anywhere from slavery, Jim Crow era, blacks in the military, Buffalo Soldiers, Dr. Martin Luther King, the civil rights, black women's made a difference, movies.
Tuskegee Airmen.
World War I, World War II. We got sports, musicians, Jack Robinson, Mac Robinson, who's my brother-in-law, Jack's brother. We got, like I mentioned, Jim Crow. We got poets and writers. So, collect and local history, collecting all of this. So we decided to get a museum assessment person to come in and sort of assess our museum and tell us what most important thing we should do and sort of rephrase our mission. Came in, she rephrased the mission. We need to be focusing more on local history. And she said, y'all need to be more visible downtown. And so the Imperial Hotel came up then, but I put a deaf ear to it because of the fact that I knew I couldn't afford to buy the hotel and get it started. So we put it in back burner, but there were other people who still had interest. Brian Renyon from the Thomasville Landmarks. And then we got Mary Lawrence Lane, who's with the current Landmarks. But through my grant writer, Marilyn Amon, who's been with me, writing grants for me for the past 20 years, Marilyn came on board. She's been writing, so she encouraged me to move forward with the positive risk theater. I said, no, we need to wait. But all of a sudden, one of my board members, Don Sims, he heard a conversation downtown I guess that the owner wants to sell the Imperial Hotel. Mm. And so he came back to the board and told, I said, well, go tell him if you're going to give it to us, we'll take it. Mm. But the owner, he came back at the next meeting and said, no. He said, he'll sell it to us. He said, he'll sell it to us for 40 grand. I said, I ain't got no 40 grand to buy no hotel. Mm. But within a week, the community came together, the Tommy's Landmarks, the Williams Family Foundation came together and challenged the $20,000 for us to purchase it, and we purchased that hotel. And so it was like a gift sitting in my hand. Then.
So they basically challenged others to contribute.
They challenged each other themselves.
Yeah.
To come up with the initiative for the hotel. So we purchased a hotel. And with no plans. Here I got a hotel, never thought that I would own. But then I realized what I was getting into. Then I asked my nephew, Eugene Weatherspoon, said, Jack, Uncle Jack, you need to buy that little shotgun house next door. If you don't, somebody can come and put a little hot dog stand there or either buy it, and then you won't have no parking space. So I talked to another foundation, and she gave me the money to buy that. And then another one gave me some money to buy to help stabilize it. So within less than a month, I received $80,000.
That's remarkable. And all of this has happened just recently. I mean, within
last March, April, during last March, past year.
About a year.
So we moved forward with that, and then everybody said, what you going to do with it? So we had to come up with some plan. We still don't know exactly, but we said we're going to use it since the city of Thomasville got a comprehensive plan for 2028.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is on the gateway coming to Thomasville. We said we'll use the lower unit. It's an 8-bedroom hotel upstairs, and then they got bedroom, they got office space, a barber shop, restroom down in the kitchen on the first floor, and then a bedroom. We use the lower unit as a rotating exhibits. We'll do that. We'll put rotating exhibits up there. But we're still working on a plan, trying to get a business plan going, and I'll probably have to go and pay someone to write it for to tell us exactly what, even though our wish list is an Airbnb, either office space or either training center for the 8 rooms upstairs.
Yeah, yeah.
And but we gotta make sure we put something up there that can bring money in.
Right.
A lot of people say Airbnb would be the idea.
Right.
So, but then what about the off season? So it's gonna cost a lot of money. It's gonna cost about $1 million from what we estimated. We just this morning, we finally got the top on. We had the big a lot of the board members there and Landmarks people there. And we got the top, trusses.
Yes.
The contract just put the trusses on because we got work began already.
So the fact is that you bought this historic hotel, but it was in a state of disrepair. So it's sort of like good news, bad news. Congratulations. Now the work really begins.
Yes.
Because you got to restore this thing.
We're going to restore it, and we've already started to. We kicked it off. We got it this morning, showed the top. I guess within the next few days that they'll probably start putting the shank, they put the raft on it this morning.
And as you do that, are you subject then to those conditions and restrictions that historic societies will apply when it's an historic landmark? It has to be as authentic as possible, right? Or what are the constrictions you may have to deal
with? Landmarks, tell me the landmarks. Preservation. They pull, there's a name they use, but they pull the dome knobs out of there, window ceilings, it's different things, frames to preserve, to go back into the building. We have to keep the exterior the same. We're taking a big sign down that says Imperial Hotel. It's been removed. We got it refurbished. It is back at the museum now. In fact, it's a museum. We just keep it there till we get it up, get the building so we can put it back up and flash again. But yes, we got to follow those ground rules. We got to put the mainly the exterior have to remain the same.
Okay.
And we're looking for old pictures to make sure that we
accurate.
There was some pictures show they've been painted, and some show they did sort of.
Do you have any folks that are volunteering their time that can help on that level with professional restoration? I mean, maybe architects or historians, contractors, those kind of folks.
Well, we have Bill Evers and Charles Olson, architect, they've given us their bono time.
Okay. Otherwise,
they've done it free. They have our lead. They're the lead people that really the director of the project. In other words,
right.
I go to them for guidance.
I got
we
you.
Do have a contract, the Cornerstone Builders. They're putting the roof on us for right now. Wow. And once we get the roof on, we got Dixon Extermination. Mm-hmm. They're going to come in as Bono and do the and get the place where it kind of bummed out.
Yeah, it, right.
Termite infected from the bad weather. Get that squared right away. And then we're going to start from there. We'll do by layer. We're going to start raising, kicking off big campaigns to raise money to start the renovation. By that time, we should have the plan put together. But before we really do the plan, we need to have something, you know, the business plan that would tell our funders exactly what we're going to do with it, how much it's going to cost.
Yep. You need that prospectus.
But I do have people that wants to volunteer, but not the kind of volunteer
not
they
at this
want.
Point.
They, no.
Right.
They
yeah,
want to volunteer to come clean up, but we don't want to do that now because it still has a place to go in. But
yeah, we need to volunteer and help you raise the money. That's what we need to do.
That's
and how much do you know you need, or do you know?
The estimate from the architect, about $1 million is what it's going
to
take.
To put it all back together.
Put it all back together, put it all together. It's going to call
it. That's chump change.
Gonna,
come on, $1 million bucks?
Yeah, it's,
in today's economy, man, that's nothing.
Excuse me.
We're spending that as we sit here. Folks, we got Jack Hadley in the studio. Fascinating guy, somebody you want to get to know. And write him a check, just, you know, because he needs your help. And we all do. We need to preserve this historic structure. The Imperial Hotel we're talking about up there in Thomasville. Part of the Tallahassee community, if you believe that. I do. Stay with me.
When you place a document in someone's hand, it should reach more than their head. It needs to reach their heart with compelling visuals and dramatic presentations right down to the paper it's printed on. Rapid Press reaches the hearts of thousands of people every day with commercial printing and mailing services for organizations that feed and house children, for businesses that bring vital products and services to our community, and for theaters, festivals, and orchestras reaching bigger audiences and bringing joy to life. Rapid Press commercial printers since 1983.
For digital printing, offset printing, finishing, and mailing services, reach for Rapid Press. When you're ready to share your vision, excite your customers, and reach the hearts of your audience, reach for Rapid Press. You'll find them online at rapidpress.com or call 893-7346. 893-7346. Rapid Press, the power of print.
Hi, I'm Jerry.
And I'm Pete.
And we're with the Jerry Thigpen Trio, and you're listening to Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
So we're back. We're talking with Jack Hadley. You had your career in the military. How many years were you in the Air Force?
I spent 28 years and 14 days.
Right down to it.
Yes.
And had a wife and kids that during that time, and you served in Vietnam for a period of time.
Yes.
So you were, in genuine terms, you're a combat veteran and served the country well. You know, growing up in the South, and we will have to have you come back on the show and we can just talk at length about some of your personal history, family history, because you got a lot of stories there. You still live in Thomasville.
Yes,
ma'am. And but you were born, reared in Thomasville. What was the name of the plantation?
I was born out on Pepper Hill Plantation, which is located 7 miles south of 319 south of Thomasville.
Yeah, Pebble Hill.
I was born there, and I'm the 10th child of 14 brothers and sisters.
Wow.
And we have one sister passed and five brothers has passed. I'm the last one that's living. And my dad raised them all out there on the plantation. My dad worked out, his name was Kane Dennis Hadley. He worked out there for 53 years. He raised all his kids out there and sent them off to college. But one thing I did not realize, Mrs. Pansy Allen Polk, she was a benevolent person that helped the kids go off to college. It's just a matter of once you finish the seventh grade, and you know, transportation on Pepper Hill was very, we didn't have a problem there because one of my cousins, Mrs. Ruth Hadley, had a station wagon van, like truck van, that she picked the kids all up and took them to school for the next 40, 50 years, and then when she retired. So we always had transportation. So the kids out there had no excuse not to go to college and not to go to finish high school. So most of the kids on the plantation went off to college. You'd be surprised, you know, with the small salary. My dad was working about $75 a month, but he survived. And we all survived.
And it was because she was putting up the money to send them off to school.
With the musical scholarship that my family's putting music at Klein except myself. I look at preachers all day long, but they like music. And I like music too, but not to the extent.
Yeah.
And so on. Yeah. But he raises, and we all eventually moved into the city, but he continued to work out there.
Huh.
And then, of course, 2 weeks after I graduated, I went in the Air Force and stayed there for 28 years.
Right.
You thought when you joined the military things would have changed, but mm-hmm. in the uniform is okay. But after you got in there, put that uniform on, it was the same, you know. And even back in the day, now keep one thing in mind. I lived through the Dr. Martin Luther King period of time, but I was in the military.
Right, right.
You know, we could not get out in the streets and march, but I remember many days I just wished I could be part of that marching crew, but the military didn't tolerate that. Yeah. You had your freedom in the military.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But then I reflect back when I say, okay, in high school, we had the same problem. You know, the principal would tell us that, Jack, I graduated when I was 20 years old because I didn't do what I should have done when I was in grade school. The teacher kept me back. Mm-hmm. And I use that to tell kids today, you better study because the teacher will keep you back. But I came out at 20, but I was only allowed to drive a school bus. And the principal would tell us, Jack, take the bus and go over to the other school and pick up all those books and bring them back. But we began to use books. And when I bought when we moved into the museum, the Douglas Complex, there was a whole warehouse full of nothing but old books.
Wow.
And I said, you know, these are the books we would have got. We would have got those used books in the back school.
Right.
But, you know, they was getting new books all along, giving us the old books. But I'm just saying, these are just little bits and pieces of that. You know, it never leaves you, I guess, but I use it, the healing is to, just like the museum is a healing place, I use it to help heal myself and help heal my guest that comes to the museum.
Uh-huh.
You know, we got to talk about it.
And it's interesting that you take that position. Some would say, why do we even need to talk about the past? Let's just block it out of our minds, or let's get it out of our view. And your attitude is, no, let's talk about it.
Got to tell a story. Uh-huh. You got to tell a story. I have a Jim Crow era there in the museum. People come there and say, why you have to do it? I said, because our kids need to know what this is all about. Mm-hmm. The school system teaches us a little bit in the classroom, but they need to see it on hand. I'm blessed that I got a grant. I've got two grants. I've got one grant in 2016 for $115,000 to hire a museum educator.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a follow-up again in 2018 to another grant to keep him another 3 years. So I have a total of 6 years to keep this young man there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's putting together a pilot program named Jamarcus Underwood, putting together a pilot program to take the museum to the classroom.
That's awesome.
To take those objects, Jim Crow objects, or civil rights objects, anything that kids can touch and feel about. Only thing I'm really looking for now, I got everything in the Jim Crow section, Confederate flag, the Jim Crow dolls, all the images. I need a cape and a hood. Then I can complete that Jim Crow section. And it's just the idea that it's part of being in the museum, you know, to help educate our people. I just want to educate our kids. Mm-hmm. I want to educate the community that it's okay. These things happen, but there's nothing we can do about it. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to forget that part of it. 400 years.
Yeah.
And we've been here 400 years on this earth. Been 400 years in America.
Right.
We have helped build and shape this country. We've made a whole lot of inventions. Scientists and doctors and lawyers, the whole works.
Right.
And we've done all these things. So we want to keep it going, but we need to know where we came from.
Yeah, and I think all of us need to know where we're going.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that. Folks, Jack Hadley, we're just getting started with this young man. He's got a lot to tell us, and I think you're going to find yourself not only being transported through time, but you're going to learn a whole lot about American history at large and a lot about local history and where we're going, where we're headed. Take it in. Make it part of your weekend. Get up there to Thomasville and check it out, the Jack Hadley Black History Museum. Founded and directed by the one and only Jack Hadley, our guest this morning. We're going to be looking for ways we can help you raise that $1 million you need for the Imperial Hotel restoration.
Well, let me see if
we can help you out with that, too.
Let me say this now. We're located at 214 Alexander Street here in Thomasville, Georgia, 31792.
Right.
But if I don't say this, I probably cannot get in my house when I go home. I am married to my wife for 62 years, Christine Jackson Hadley.
Smart man.
Who was born on Greenwood Plantation.
And that's why you're still married, by the way.
Yeah, 62
You're smart
years,
enough to
I
do
got,
this.
I got three daughters, two daughters, and a son. My son, who Jim is 57 years old, 56 years old. My daughter is 57. My youngest daughter is 55. And I got five grands and one great-grands. And all my five grands are all out of school. And just a great grandson.
God bless you, man.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
So I need to put that in there.
I love it. That's fantastic. Yeah, I'm bad about that stuff too. I never talk about the people that love me so much. But I'm glad you did, and I'm glad you were here, and I'm glad to be your friend. It's good to have a new friend in my life, and admire the work you're doing, and. We believe in you. Believe in what you're doing.
Appreciate it.
See if we can help you out.
That's what we've got for you again this week. Folks, thanks for being with me. We are the production of Spatterwork Media and Entertainment, coming to you from the studios of Moose Magnificat Radio right here in Tallahassee. Moose Magnificat, the sound of Tallahassee. You'll find us at moosemagnificat.com, playing all local musicians, their original songs, all the time. That is Moose Magnificat. Carl Cerny is our executive producer. I'll be looking for you again next week. So come on, Tallahassee, come talk to me.
Is there anything more Tallahassee than Tasty Pastry Bakery? More fresh, more original, more this is why I love this town, kind of delicious? I don't think so. You know, they've been in business since 1963, working through the night to be ready the next morning with muffins, coffee cakes, bread and pastries, and my personal favorite, fresh-made bagels and Lucky Goat coffee. Yeah, it helps get me out in the morning. And they deliver to the many restaurants, clubs, and coffee shops that serve their bread, muffins, and quiche. Never stuffy, never stale, just Tasty Pastry Good. It's the perfect blend of world-class talent, pure, simple ingredients, and down-home Tallahassee family tradition. Maybe they should call it Tasty Tally Bakery, but then why mess with something that's been working for 55 years? Yeah, you want something fresh and fantastic? There's a Tasty Pastry just waiting for you in the Market District on Market Street, 6:45 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. You want to know more? They're online at tastypastrybakery.com or call them at 893-3752.